Matato took up his position in the bows of the frail craft. Sean and Ricardo were amidships, sitting on their depleted packs and holding their rifles across their laps. Pumula stood in the stern with one of the freshly cut punt poles and propelled the dugout in response to Matatu's hand signals. Within seconds of pushing off from the bank, they were surrounded by a high palisade of papyrus, and their view was restricted to the wall of reeds and the small patch of lemon-yellow dawn sky overhead. As they passed, the sharp-pointed leaves of the reeds were dashed into their faces, threatening their eyes, and the webs that the tiny swamp spiders had spun between the stems of the reeds wrapped over their faces, sticky and irritating. The night's clammy chill hung over the swamp, and when they came out suddenly into an open lagoon, there was a heavy mist lying over the surface, and a flock of whistling duck alarmed the dawn with a clatter of their wings. The dugout was heavily overloaded with the four men aboard. There was only an inch or so of freeboard, and if any one of them moved suddenly, water slopped on board, and they were forced to use the T-billy to bail almost continually. But Matatu signalled them on. The sun rose above the papyrus, and immediately the mist twisted into rising tendrils and then was gone. The water lilies opened their cerulean blossoms and turned them to face the sunrise. Twice they saw large crocodiles lying with just their eye knuckles exposed. They sank below the surface as the dugout slid towards them. The swamps were alive with birds. Bitterns and secretive night herons lurked in the reed beds like chocolate-brown jacanas danced over the lily pads on their long legs, while Goliath herons as tall as a man fished the black waters of the lagoons. Overhead, winged formations of pelicans and white egrets, cormorants and darters with serpentine necks, and huge flocks of wild duck of a dozen different species. The heat built up swiftly and was reflected from the surface of the water into their faces so that the two white men were soon sweating through their shirts. At places, the water was only a few inches deep, and they were forced to climb out and drag the dugout through to the next channel or lagoon. Under the matted reeds, the mud was black and foul-smelling and reached to their knees. In the shallower places, the elephants' pads had left deep, circular, water-filled craters in the mud banks. The spoor of the old bull led them deeper and even deeper into the swamplands. But there was consolation in the swift progress that the dugout made across the lagoons and channels, thrust on by the long punt pole. For a while, Sean spelled Pumula in the stern, but soon Pumula could no longer abide his clumsy strokes and took the pole away from him. There was only room for one man to stretch out at the bottom of the dugout. Ricardo slept in it that night, while the others sat waist-deep in the mud, leaning against the hull of the canoe, and took what rest the clouds of mosquitoes allowed them. Early the next morning, when Sean stood up out of the mud, he found that his bare legs were swarming with black leeches. The repulsive worms were attached to his skin, bloated with the blood they'd sucked from him. Sean used a little of their precious supply of salt to rid himself of them. To pull them loose would leave a wound into which the leech had injected anticoagulants, and which would continue to bleed profusely and probably become infected. However, a dab of salt on each leech made them twist and contort with agony and fall off, leaving only a sealed wound on the skin. When he opened his trousers, Sean found that they had crawled up into the cleft between his buttocks and were hanging like black grapes from his genitalia. He shuddered with horror as he worked on them, while safely in the dugout, Ricardo watched with interest and made a facetious comment. "Hey, Sean, this must be the first time you've ever objected to a bit of head." Sean set the end of the punt pole in the mud and steadied it, while Matatu shinned up it like a monkey and peered ahead. When he came down, he told Sean, "I can see the islands. We are very close. We will be there before noon, and unless Tukutila has heard us, he will be on one of the islands." Sean knew from flights over the area and from study of his large-scale map that the islands formed a chain between the swamplands and the main channel of the Zambezi. They dragged the dugout through the shallows, Sean hauling on the nylon rope tied to the bows, and Pumula and Matatu shoving in the stern. When Ricardo offered to assist, Sean told him, "Take a free ride, Capo. I want you nicely rested, so that you don't have any excuses if you mess up your shot at Tucutila." At last Sean saw the fronds of the palm trees rising above the screen of papyrus ahead, and abruptly the water deepened, and he went under to his chin. He dragged himself out, and they all clambered back on board. Pumula poled them through to the first island. The vegetation was so dense that it overhung the water, and they had to push their way through to reach the shore. The earth was grey and sandy, leached by a million floods, but it was good to have dry land underfoot. Sean spread out their wet clothing and equipment to dry, while Matatu slipped away to make a circuit of the island. The water had just boiled in the billy when Matatu was back. "Yes," he nodded at Sean, "he passed here yesterday early, while we were leaving the village, but he has settled down now. The peace of the river is upon him, and he feeds quietly. He left this island at sunrise this morning."
"Which way did he go?" Sean asked, and Matatu pointed.
"There is another larger island close by."
"Let's take a look."
Sean poured a mug of tea for Ricardo and left him with Pumula, while he and Matatu skirted the northern shore, forcing their way through the dense growth until they reached the base of the tallest tree on the island and climbed into its top branches. Sean settled into a high crotch of the tree, snapped off the few leafy twigs that obscured his view, and gazed out on a scene of magnificent desolation. He was 60 feet above the island and could see to the misty horizon. The Zambezi flowed past the island. Its waters were an opaque, glassy green, so wide that distance had reduced the great trees that lined the far bank to a dark band that separated green water from the high alps of cumulus cloud that soared anvil-headed into the blue African sky. The Zambezi flowed so swiftly that its surface was ruffled by eddies and whirlpools and wayward countercurrents. Floating carpets of swamp grass had been torn loose by the current and sailed past, seeming as substantial as the island beneath him. Sean thought about crossing that forbidding river in the frail dugout. It would take more than one trip to get them all across, and he abandoned the idea. There was only one way out, and that was back the way they'd come. He transferred all his attention to the chain of islands which stood like sentinels between the Mother River and her spreading swamps. The nearest island in the chain was 300 meters away. The channel between was clogged with reeds and water hyacinth and lily pads. The blooms of the water lilies were spots of electric blue against the green water, and even in the treetop Sean could catch wafts of their perfume. Sean raised his binoculars and meticulously swept the channel and the nearest shore of the island, for even a great elephant could be swallowed up by the sweep and magnitude of this land and waterscape. Suddenly his nerves jumped as he saw movement, weighty and ponderous in the reeds, and the gleam of wet hide in the sunlight. His excitement was stillborn, followed by the pull of disappointment in his guts, as he recognised the broad, misshapen head of a hippopotamus emerging from the swamps. In the lens of his binoculars, he could see the pink-shot piggy eyes and the bristles in the disproportionately tiny ears. The hippo fluttered them like the wings of a bird, shaking off the droplets that sparkled like diamond chips, forming a halo above its huge head. It plodded through the mud, crossing from one lagoon to another, pausing only to loosen an explosive jet of liquid dung that it splattered with a violent stirring motion of its stubby tail. The force of this discharge flattened the reeds behind the obese animal. With relief, Sean watched it move on and submerge itself in the further lagoon. The rotten hull of the dugout would have offered no protection from those heavy curved tusks in the gape of huge jaws. At last, Sean glanced across at Matatu in the fork beside him, and the little Ndrobo shook his head. "He has moved on. So must we." They scrambled down to the ground and went back to where they had left Ricardo. The voyage in the Mokoro and a good night's sleep had invigorated him.
He was on his feet, impatient and eager for the hunt, the way Sean had known him before.
"Anything?" he demanded.
"No," Sean shook his head. "But Matatu reckons we're close. Absolute silence from now on."
While they loaded the dugout, Sean gulped a mug of the scalding tea and kicked sand over the fire. They punted and pushed the canoe across the channel to the next island. And once again Sean climbed into a treetop, while Matatu scurried into the dense undergrowth to pick up the elephant's spoor again. He was back within 15 minutes, and Sean slid out of the tree to meet him.
"He has moved on," Matatu whispered. "But the wind is bad."
He looked grave and took the ash bag from his loincloth and shook out a puff of powdery white ash to demonstrate.
"See how it turns and changes like the fancy of a Shangani whore."
Sean nodded, and before they crossed to the next island, he stripped off his sleeveless bush shirt. Naked from the waist up, he could feel instantly the slightest vagary of the breeze on the sensitive skin of his upper body. On the next island, they found where Tukutila had left the water to go ashore, and the mud he had smeared on the brush as he passed was still slightly damp. Matatu shivered with excitement, like a good dog getting his first whiff of the bird. They left the canoe and crept forward, feeling their way through the heavy bush, thankful for the breeze that clattered the palm fronds overhead to cover the small sounds of their footfalls in the dead leaves and dry twigs. They found where the old elephant had shaken down the nuts from one of the palms and stuffed them down his throat without chewing them, with his last worn set of molars, but he had moved on again.
"Run," Sean whispered, fearful that the bull might have sensed their presence, but Matatu assured him with a quick shake of his head, pointed to the green twigs that the elephant had stripped of bark and left scattered along his tracks. The raw twigs had not completely dried out, but the spoor led them on a meandering beat across the island and then once more plunged into the channel on the far side. They sent Pumula back to bring the dugout around to where they waited, and when he arrived, piled Ricardo into it and pushed him across, wading waist-deep beside him, moving stealthily and silently until they reached the next island. Here they found a pile of dung, spongy and soft with reeds and hyacinth that the bull had eaten, and beside it was the splash mark of his urine, as though a garden hose had been played upon the earth. It was still so wet that Sean scooped a handful of the dirt and moulded it into a ball like a child's mud cake. The pile of dung had a dry crust, but when Matatu thrust his foot into it, it was moist as porridge, and he exclaimed with delight at the body heat still trapped within.
"Close! Very close!" he whispered excitedly.
Instinctively, Sean reached for the cartridges looped on his belt, and he changed them for those in the double-barreled rifle, careful to mute the click of the rifle's sidelock as he closed it. Ricardo recognized the gesture. He had seen it so often before, and he grinned with excitement and clicked the Rigby's safe catch on and off, on and off. They crept forward in single file, but disappointment dragged them down again as the spoor led them across the islands and then, on the far side, once more entered the papyrus beds.